Well, welcome to this crossover episode of Sloth Files. Is that what we called it the first
time?
Yeah,
yes, this is the second time. Yeah, Sloth Files, I believe. I like that.
Well, third time's the charm, so I guess let's just delete this one and start again. wow, this is great. I've been a fan of the text files for, I guess, like a year and a half or 2 years.
You're like
now.
Our first friend online, really.
Oh yeah, I came in back in the Spider Horse days.
Spider Horse, yeah. Yes. I still like the pictures you drew.
Oh yeah, I totally goofed off at work, my old job, to make those, and here we are.
So. But as that's Carl from the Sloth Pod. He's a good friend of ours, and I'm Michael B from the TX Files, and so we're going to be doing a little crossover for y'all this week. You know, kind of like both of our shows deal with, you know, some weird topics, some weird stuff, and Carl and I are both pretty big fans of weird stuff. So we thought we'd get y'all like a little UFO like alien type episode.
Yeah.
So that's always fun. So, Carl, if you want to go into what is our topic of the day?
Well, our topic today is going to take us across the pond. Ooh. Over to get some fish and chips.
Merry old England.
Up to the tower where the queen cannibalizes human children. Because
as
today,
a lizard.
We're talking about the Rendlesham Forest incident.
A classic.
The Roswell of the UK. Although still on an American military base. So
yeah,
maybe
think of that what you will.
Also ours.
Yeah. It kind of counts, I think. Did you know anything about this before you and I started researching it?
I knew a little bit about it. And actually, I think the part I knew about was that there had also been like Bigfoot type sightings.
I hadn't heard that, but I think on our last time we recorded,
yeah,
I think you brought it up. But yeah, that's gonna be a really cool.
I think the Bigfoot stuff is totally separate from the incidents, the alien stuff. But I do think it is something that happens. Like it's one of those hot spots where a lot of weird stuff continues to happen to this day. But
yeah. And you see spots like that all over the world, you know, like the Bridgewater Triangle or like Skinwalker, even kind of places, you know, where there's like a lot of weird stuff.
I've been noticing recently that like my wife and I moved to Kentucky from Washington, D.C. And like there's a lot of weird stuff in Kentucky. There's like Bobby Mackey's, which is super haunted.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's the Waverly Sanitarium, which is like booked up for a year straight for people
that's cool.
Going ghost hunting, all kinds of alien and Bigfoot stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I guess let's hop in the time machine.
Yeah. And I think all I knew was just like History Channel documentaries and stuff on this. So I didn't really have a lot really going into it besides just kind of what I'd seen on TV and Coast before. So
it's surprising how crazy it was and was not really investigated that much.
Yeah. And this is like the case for me, other than the Phoenix Lights, really, that I think is almost, I think the best proof that something's going on. There's been cover-ups at the very least. And so like, I think this is a great case for that. Which it comes from, you know, military witnesses, which we regard as, you know, more credible, I think, because they're kind of stuck in like a rigid hierarchy, you know? And so if you speak up and say something crazy, you know, like any kind of place, you're going to get kind of looked down upon.
Oh yeah.
And so these guys are, you know, to be saying something like that, if you're, you know, like the kind of witnesses you look for researching this stuff are like, you know, doctors, cops, or like military people.
Yeah.
Just cause generally they're, in our side is more trusted, I guess, for better or worse. But they do seem to have like more to lose, and so you kind of, I think, a little bit goes with that. But also the sense that this one just has a lot of stuff in there, and a lot of it was done live, and it's recorded live as it happens. And so I really like this one, so I'm excited to get into it again.
Oh yeah, well, let's hop in the time machine, take it on back to 1980. It's December 26th, just after Christmas. It's 3 a.m. in the morning. And Airman John Burroughs, who's 20 years old, he's been in the Air Force for 2 years, and he's been stationed at Woodbridge Air Force Base, which I guess is where this takes place.
Yeah, it's in on the east coast of England, I believe, near Suffolk.
Yeah, and we said Rendlesham Forest incident, but Rendlesham Forest is just, that's just the woods beside Woodbridge Air Base. And Woodbridge Air Base is actually, it's like a sister base of Bentwaters Air Base, is that correct?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Side by side.
Bentwaters is in Suffolk, I'm sorry.
I think they're both. I think they're like touching, just gingerly touching.
Very ginger, you know, back in 1980. So I guess kind of to set the scene for that, there was the Cold War was going on. I think that's going to play has some relevancy in this case. Just with the space race and all this other kind of stuff going on and the development of technology. So I think that's going to be kind of to keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah, definitely.
For 1980, you know, there's a lot of who knows going on technology-wise behind the scenes. So,
yeah. So Airman John Burroughs, 20 years old. He's on he's on guard duty on patrol by the East Gate, which from what I understand is the most boring job because you're just walking around staring at nothing most of the time.
Yeah, I can't imagine that being very exciting, especially it doesn't sound fun. I don't really know what to say about it.
Well, it's also like the night of Christmas. So,
oh, yeah, that sucks.
So, like, everybody else is partying
and
having fun. And he's probably just like, dang, it's cold and probably raining, and I'm sitting here.
Definitely.
But his sergeant, Bud Stevens, pulls up in a truck, and it sounds like they might have just been, like, cool bros because...
he got a name like Bud Stevens.
Yeah,
you are
Bud.
A cool bro. That's so cool. Like, Bud Stevens definitely beat up some nerds in high school.
Absolutely. And it sounds to me like he was also bored and said, hey, Burroughs, let's hop in this Jeep and drive around instead of like walking around separately. And we'll just drive around, maybe have a little secret Christmas indulgence, maybe a little secret eggnog hidden in a boot flask.
These guys are probably, I mean, can you blame them?
Absolutely not.
Really cannot.
It's probably freezing.
And...
They pull up in a truck.
Yeah. The commies did not attack, so I think that we could give them the benefit of the doubt looking back.
Yeah, even if they were intoxicated, which is completely just my conjecture in this story. No thing to support that.
No, but yeah.
They still did an excellent job, it sounds like, guarding stuff, because a few minutes into driving around near Rendlesham Forest, Stevens notices a weird light in the woods, and... he says, well, that's not right. Can't have lights sneaking around in the woods next to our military base. Because we didn't say this, but Bentwaters / Woodbridge was a nuclear-armed base at this time. It wasn't public knowledge, but it has since come out that there were nuclear weapons there. So
yeah, and that's another thing that you're going to see again and again in UFO lore is... UFOs shutting down or being around particularly American nuclear facilities. There's a documentary I heard about on Coast. I can't remember the name off the top of my head now about it. It's on YouTube. It's about an hour long, and it just kind of goes through all these different cases of unidentified objects, you know, either shutting down nuclear facilities or buzzing by the launch sites. And it's just a documentary, all these, officers and soldiers testifying and talking about it. And it's really interesting. You should go on YouTube and check that out if you can. But I think that's another thing, like especially during the Cold War, we saw – that's when a lot of these UFOs around nuclear bases was going on as well. That's a really – there's a lot of stuff in UFO lore that all kind of comes together in the story. And I think that's why it's such a fun one.
That's true. We actually – we did a recent episode called Between a Rock and Ashtar Place. And
Ashtar.
There's a lot of weird stuff in that one, but all the instances of quote-unquote aliens communicating with us during that story were basically aliens saying stop using nuclear weapons because it's going to blow not just you up, but also us somehow, which was interesting. But
yeah, and that's when all the UFO craze started, was after the war. And, you know, there's a lot of theories going into that, that, you know, are they preventing us from blowing up ourselves or blowing up other people, you know, other, you know, civilizations, yeah. I guess, going forward. You know, there's some, who knows, you know, it's very weird. And I think if there is any kind of motivation for them, I would imagine that would be it.
Oh, absolutely. So Burroughs and Stevens, they see this light. They say, that's weird. They go back to the gate where they're supposed to be and call the flight desk on a secure line because they don't want to broadcast it over the radio. And Burroughs gets hold of the CSC, which stands for Central Security Control, which sounds very important. I don't know exactly what it is, but it obviously is important. And they send out a guy named Sergeant Jim. I want to make sure I get this name right. Peniston.
Penistown, I think, is what we should go with.
Penistown. He was 26 years old, so by far the elder of this situation. And he had been a security policeman in the Air Force for 7 years. And you've seen this guy in the interviews. He's the one with the glasses. And even to this day, he seems like the most uptight of all of the
you gotta witnesses. Be, you have to be serious if your name's Penis Town. Like, you can't. Yeah. You got to be so much.
You got to be so much more serious than everyone else.
Yeah. I had a teacher in high school, and he was a real cool – he was a really nice teacher, history teacher. Everyone liked him, you know. But he was like a really little guy, really kind of nerdy looking guy, and his name was Patrick Enos. So it was Penos. And so we all liked him, but no one ever teased him about it, but we'd always kind of talk about it behind his back because it's funny.
I had a vice principal named Mr. Johnson who shaved his head like slick bald, and he had one of those like weird bumps in the back, so it was like a real his head was shaped like a dick, and it just really everything worked out perfect for just the budding cartoonist that I was.
Lots of doodle material.
Oh yeah, sorry Mr. Johnson, that was me, if you're listening. So Sergeant Peniston and his driver arrive at the East Gate where Burroughs and Stevens are. They show him the light in the woods, and then Peniston says, I think that's an aircraft crash. And I think this is the funniest part. He has to call back to the CSC for clearance to go investigate a possible downed craft. So, like, they sent him there to ask questions and see what was going on, and then he has to ask for further permission to actually go see what was going on.
See, he should have just been a go-getter. Because, like, that's not how you get things done in movies. Like,
yeah.
If this was a movie, you go out there, guns blazing, and you figure that shit out.
Absolutely. So Peniston tries to get as much info from Stevens as he can, who just says it landed, and he's really too scared to do much of anything. So Peniston sends him back to his post, and he takes Burroughs and his driver, Airman Edward Cabansag, very interesting name. They take the truck to the edge of the forest, and when it can't go any farther, they walk on foot into those woods, looking for that light. Had to get a little sip of La Croix there.
Yes.
So like 50 meters in, they start having radio interference. So they decide to string out to maintain radio contact. So Cabansag kind of hangs out near the Jeep, and then Burroughs hangs out, I guess, around 50 meters from Cabansag, and then Peniston goes in the rest of the way alone so he can maintain contact with them. And he says at some point he feels an electrical charge in the air. He came to a clearing, which was lit up by a bright light, and then he gets within 10 feet of that clearing, and the light dims. And he has a camera with him. He takes pictures. of a triangular-shaped craft, 9 feet wide and 8 feet high, completely smooth, that makes no sound.
Yeah. Just like a... Like I also kind of saw it described as like a... Is it almost like see-through almost? Like kind of like a glassy... Like it's just like a shiny... And he has some drawings of it.
He too. Has some drawings. He takes notes about all this because he's got his little... Snitch's notebook. And he's taking notes, which he... There's hieroglyphs. I actually found the hieroglyphs. I mean, they're just on Google Images, but they're pretty funky looking. And he does touch the craft, and he said it was warm and smooth like glass.
Mm.
So it's an interesting texture, but I think very brave to touch it, because like even if it was like a meteor or something, surely it would still be so hot that it would
be
like,
burning up,
burn your hand. Yeah. So I don't know how that worked out, but. He also notices symbols on it. That's the hieroglyphs we were talking about. He writes those down. He said it was 6 symbols, and they were, all together, they were 3 feet wide.
They kind of look like, one of them is kind of just like a triangle in a circle, which is, I don't know the name of that, but you see that in some occult stuff, I guess. And then the other one just kind of look like messed up Legos. So it's kind of weird. We'll put a link to it on in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one that looks like a beer funnel.
Yeah.
And there's one that looks like kind of like a teepee.
A saxophone. In the middle.
Absolutely a saxophone. And then there's just like 2 big rectangle ones. One that has a triangle sticking out of it, and the other one has just like a weird knob shape sticking out of it. They are pretty odd symbols, but, then, I was just going to say, then the, object flashes really bright and takes off very quickly. And then they see another light through the trees, but they then realize the second light is the nearby lighthouse, the Orford Ness Lighthouse, which is only a couple miles away. And at this point it is 2 a.m.
Yes. And I think, the most interesting part of all this is that Sergeant Peniston, he touched one of the main glyphs. And then he says, like, after that happened, the next day he had some kind of like a download from touching the glyphs, which was a binary code. And he wrote down 16 pages of this binary code.
Yeah. 16 pages of binary.
Yeah, and some of it, I have it pulled up, the decoded part, and it's talking about like the exploration of humanity, continuous planetary advances, coordinates. But the coordinates, this is very interesting, is that one of them is High Brazil, which is like the mythical land off the coast of Ireland, I think they couldn't find. One of them is Sedona, Arizona, which is a... supposedly like a ley line hotspot of like magnetism, you know.
Excellent.
And the other ones are gonna make a lot of sense to people, the Great Pyramids and the Nazca lines. So he somehow downloaded all this information. I don't think he knew all that stuff off the top of his head. I'm just gonna say in 1980 probably didn't know that.
No, pre Google, I think it would be pretty tough to to find all those coordinates and then translate them into binary.
And these are all direct interpretations. Like very little is added to the decoding that they couldn't figure out. I'd probably say 95% of it is letter for letter or whatever. and that's just another. I mean, that's weird.
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, even if he just randomly put ones and zeros, like it at least wouldn't make sense. Like your only options are that he faked it very elaborately, or it was some kind of legitimate transmission.
No, yeah. And if you're able to write 16 pages of binary code that like makes sense and like tell something in 1980, I would imagine like you're pretty like advanced, right?
Yeah. Why are you like, wasting your time as an Air Force policeman?
Yeah, why are you being a guard? Like you should be programming stuff. Like, that would take a lot of knowledge to
yeah.
to have.
Absolutely.
He'd probably be like a programmer in the military or somewhere else. So it's, I don't think this guy just made it up or bullshitted it or studied it or something.
No, in fact, he didn't realize that it was binary, right? Until like after
2010.
Yeah, 2010, when somebody else looked at his notes and was like, oh, this is binary. Let's translate it. Yeah. So, So, I definitely don't think, because he didn't even understand what the binary meant. So,
yeah, it's just really, that's the weirdest part.
Yeah.
To me,
it's super, super bizarre. So they radio back to the CSC. I don't know why it was okay to radio back this time instead of calling. Maybe they were just too freaked out. But the CSC orders them to make contact with a security team back at the East Gate. So they go back. They're debriefed later that morning, which we'll talk about later. And Peniston claims that the shift commander told them to forget it. That Project Blue Book, the Air Force's official investigation into all this stuff, was over. And it's just best to
leave. Which we found out recently. Officially, it is not over, as if you've read the New York Times or anything.
Yeah, isn't that
other thing
crazy?
Else is still going on.
Oh, my goodness. So bizarre. Some of the stuff that's going on.
There's a podcast show. It's a website too, Mysterious Universe.
Yeah.
And today's episode of their podcast on whatever today is, the 5th of September, September 7th, has George Knapp on there talking about Skinwalker Ranch. And he's talking exactly kind of what we're talking about how that happened. And then people in, you and I, people that keep up with conspiracy stuff, were like, yeah. Duh.
Yeah, dude.
And everyone else is like, what? We're like, yeah, this has been happening, of course.
Yeah, but, of course. We've been saying this for years, and you've been calling us crazy.
And it's not necessarily aliens, but they've been doing this, and it's just ridiculous.
Oh, my goodness. It's really weird to me every time I, look at the news, and there's at least one, scientists say there could be alien life on Europa or something. It's like, yeah.
It's like, no
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, dude. So, Peniston says he couldn't sleep that night, so he returns to the site with some plaster of Paris, intending to make casts of any markings that he could find, which he does find. He finds three symmetrical indentations in a 9.8-foot equilateral triangle, approximately 2 to 3 inches thick, and he decides not to show those to his superiors.
Odd choice.
Well, they had already
been
like, leave it alone. Don't. There's no such thing.
That makes yeah.
But yeah, I don't know where he would put them because presumably he lived at the. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can just have weird stuff in a military base and nobody asks questions. But
I don't know.
So that's pretty much it for December 26th. The next evening, December 27th, / the morning of the 28th, there
this
are some more events.
Pick up.
Yeah,
yes.
Picks up quite a bit. So on the evening of the 27th, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hult, age 40 at the time, he was the deputy commander of Woodbridge Air Base. So he's the second in charge. Only one person in this entire base can tell him what to do. Think about
if it's
how
like,
crazy
yeah.
that is.
If it's like any other working place, it probably means he's the one in charge, really, and the other guy just kind of comes by and
it kind of sounds
approves
like
what he does.
Because he's attending a Christmas party at the officers' club, and one of Halt's men shows up, white as a sheet, and says, "It's back." Apparently, Halt was aware that men had been seeing like weird UFO stuff for the past couple days. They were at least saying that, and they were talking about it, and it was all over the base. I guess the water coolers were abuzz with this UFO sighting stuff, and so he's like, "I'm gonna put a stop to this, figure out what's going on once and for all." So he personally assembles a security team, including Disaster Preparedness Officer Staff Sergeant Monroe Nevels. Amazing name.
That's the names in this are just. They get better and better.
So good.
And also, that sounds like a British name to me. Is he British?
He is not. He kind of disappeared from the story for a long time, but I think in the 2000s they found him and he was like, yeah, I'll talk about it. So I'm pretty sure he was just an American guy, but
just a silly name.
Yeah, just a funny name. Nevels, Halt, and probably some other schmoes decide to head for Rendlesham and check this out. When they get there, there's already a security cordon in place with floodlights and trucks and a bunch of dudes standing around watching. And I believe, if I remember correctly, Halt gets kind of pissed because he's like, what are you doing? You're wasting so much electricity and like making a scene. Like, get these lights down, get the trucks out of here.
Yeah. And you got to remember, like, Halt just got pulled out of a Christmas party. You know what I mean? He is not in the mood for this bullshit.
Yeah. He's missing all the eggnog.
He's missing eggnog and just not being out in the cold. And so he's probably like, these idiots, you know, what are they making me do? And then he gets out there and there's already people and they're already kind of like cutting into his authority, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, he's like, I already don't want to be here. And people are already messing this up. Like, you know what I mean? Just like, yeah.
And I think
he's got to be annoyed.
Thought it was stupid at this point, like somebody playing a prank or something, and didn't want it to be bigger than it was, like the locals see it. Because right on the other side of Rendlesham Forest is there's like a farm right next door to the base. So he's like, I don't want this getting out. But they try to explain that the UFO is no longer visible, but the men have been experiencing outages with the floodlights, which sounds terrifying. I just recorded last night an episode about the Flatwoods Monster of Braxton County.
Oh, yeah. Great story.
And just like visually, it's so scary. Can you imagine like your floodlights flicker out and then that thing just like shows up?
Describe the
arms?
Flatwoods Monster to the homies out there.
Blood red face. Ace of spades shaped cowl / hood that goes over it. Glowing orange / green eyes, a metallic black and or dark green skirt, and long spindly arms with claws, and it hisses and glides toward you.
And it's tall, right? Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's like 10 feet tall.
Yeah. It's scary. Look, I mean, there's just, I've heard that story a few times, and I can never remember like all the creepy stuff that the monster looks like, but yeah. Ugh.
It's so scary. And actually, I found out in the course of that episode, the upcoming Fallout 76 game is going to take place in West Virginia, and it's going to have a bunch of cryptids in it, including the Flatwoods Monster. Yeah, which sounds terrifying. Can you imagine Fallout style, just like trekking through the woods at night, and then that thing comes at you? Oh, man.
That's scary.
Yeah.
I really hope. I just don't like that it's MMO. Speaking of scary games, have you played any of the Evil Within series?
I have not.
I don't know if you're like a... Well, you play like some games, I know.
I play games. I don't do a lot of scary games because I'm a wuss. Like, scary movies are fine because I'm not making the bad choices. But when it's a scary game, like, I'm going to go into this room and something bad's going to happen. And that's my fault.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, these ones are made by the man who came up with the Resident Evil games and invented all those games and produced those.
Oh, man.
And it's really cool. Like, you're like a cop and it's kind of like you're put into this like collective unconscious, right? And it's really cool. There's a lot of really cool imagery in it. It's probably the best story in a game I play. It's scary as hell, but it's also really cool. So if anyone out there is interested in playing a good, and it's like really cheap now because it's been out for a while. So I mean, there's two of them. I'm playing the second one right now, but I totally recommend playing Evil Within. Very scary, but also really fun. And yeah, play those.
Excuse me. So Halt throws a temper tantrum, tells everybody to get the F out of there. He whips out his cassette recorder, which he brought with him. I guess just had it on him at the party. Maybe they made a stop by his office or something. Probably, because he also has a Geiger counter. If any of you are super nerds and know anything about Geiger counters, it was an AN/PDR-27 model. So...
Of course.
Do it. Yeah, the classic. the Jetta of
yeah, this is my first Geiger counter, actually.
Yeah. So they go into the woods. They notice several gashes in the bark of several trees. He tells his men, stop, take pictures of those. And then he uses the AN/PDR-27 around a burned out tree and records radiation up to 0.07 millirentgens. I didn't know anything about millirentgens before reading this, but I thought, I wonder like how weird a reading that is. So I looked it up, and apparently in the average American city, the background radiation is 0.01 or 0.012 millirentgens, usually. In European cities, strangely, it's about 0.02 due to the natural radiation of stone, which I also didn't know that stone was radioactive. Weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's apparently how it goes. So this, I guess, is like 3-ish times more radiation than you would find in a city in the UK, not to mention the woods in the UK. So it is a lot of radiation, if indeed he did record it, which I don't know why he would make that up.
Yeah, I don't really have any reason to doubt like these people's responses, specifically Halt, who's recording it live as it all happens. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just to think this is like a prank or something. I mean, that would be such balls to try to do that. Well, and get 80 people in on it.
Like, he's in charge of taking care of everything in this base.
Yeah.
And like, he's got the worst job on this base probably, because not only is he responsible for pretty much everything that happens, but he's got one guy above him that is breathing down his neck like, hey, what's going on with our base? What's with this UFO thing?
Yeah.
So I don't see why he would participate.
And he's probably a career guy. You know, he's a lieutenant colonel. He's been coming up. The last thing he wants is to have to go tell some general, yeah, we're chasing aliens and Martians, you know, around. They're going to think he's a moron.
Yeah.
This is not going to be good for his career.
And you can actually listen to the cassette tapes of, like, he's there recording this whole time, just, like, tromping around in the woods on his audio recorder.
Yeah, it's about 20 minutes long. We'll put some in the show notes, a link to it. You can find it on YouTube, the whole thing, if you'd like. But it's, I mean, you can hear it, and he's very surprised.
And he sounds very sincere, yeah.
Yeah, he's, like, he just has a WTF, like, a mode about it. He's very confused. He doesn't understand it. And you also, these guys are professional airmen. You know, they see airplanes every single day of their lives for years and years and years, can identify different kind of airplanes. That's their job. And so for them, for us also to think, also have to realize, like, these guys aren't going to misidentify something light-wise or anything.
And if nothing else, Halt would know that this was a nuclear-armed base.
Mm-hmm.
And like any kind of potential security threat, whether it sounds like aliens to the men or not, like, he has to take it seriously.
Yeah.
Because if it turns out to be like, dirty commie pinkos with flashlights in the woods, like, that's a big deal. He's got to figure that out. So
they're just like two guys like, Yuli, we will go around to and infiltrate a capitalist country with nuclear alien or something. I don't know.
You shine light, I climb fence.
We will do this Soviet way.
So they're walking around in the woods. The animals in the nearby farm that we previously mentioned start making weird noises.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see a glowing light, bright red with a yellow tinge, and a dark center. I think that's a really weird part of that. Looks like it's
almost
winking.
like a zero or like a circle almost.
Yeah. Like the dark eye of Sauron kind of. Yeah. Yeah. Like a donut of fire or something.
Mm.
And, it's moving both horizontally and vertically through the trees, dripping what appears to, it looks like it's dripping molten metal, but like pieces of this bright red and yellow light are falling off of it. And they kind of follow it, and it moves into this farmer's field where it silently explodes into several white objects. And they go into the field and look around on the ground. They don't find any, like, dripping metal stuff. They don't find anything on the ground. And the objects in the sky turn and come toward them and stop over their head, shine a light on them, which would be terrifying. And then after a minute, the light just shuts off. They fly away real fast, occasionally beaming light onto the ground. And that's when Halt's recorder runs out of tape.
Yeah.
But you can hear him describe how weird it is on the tape recorder. And yeah. He's obviously, like, kicking himself that he didn't spring for, like, the the video.
So do you want me to read, since we're not going to play all of his, we're not going to play his recorder on here because it's so long. Yeah. I have pulled up his report that he sent the Department of the Air Force on January the 13th that describes his encounter.
Oh, yeah. I believe after everybody gets debriefed, which I think is like the next day or the next couple days, he is asked to prepare a memo about this whole situation. So, yeah, go ahead and...
Okay. So he's sending this to the RAF and his superior, I suppose. So this is from 13th of January, 1981. So paragraph one. Early in the morning of 27th of December, 1980, around 3 in the morning, two USAF security police patrolmen saw unusual lights outside the back gate at RAF Woodbridge. Thinking an aircraft might have crashed or been forced down, they called for permission to go outside the gate to investigate. The on-duty flight chief responded and allowed the three patrolmen to proceed on foot. The individuals reported seeing a strange glowing object in the forest. The object was described as being metallic in appearance and triangular in shape, approximately 2 to 3 meters across the base and approximately 2 meters high. It illuminated the entire forest with a white light. The object itself had a pulsing red light on top and the banks of blue lights underneath. The object was hovering or on legs. As the patrolman approached the object, it maneuvered through the trees and disappeared. At this time, the animals on a nearby farm went into a frenzy. The object was briefly sighted approximately an hour later near the back gate. So then he goes on to describe the next day when they check for radiation at the place, and he kind of logs the depressions and the stuff in the that were left. And so in the third paragraph, he goes, later in the night, a red sunlike light was seen through the trees. It moved about and pulsed. At one point, it appeared to throw off glowing particles and then broke into five separate white objects and then disappeared. Immediately thereafter, three star-like objects were noticed in the sky, two objects to the north and one to the south, all of which displayed movements all of which were about 10 degrees off the horizon. The objects moved rapidly in sharp angular movements and displayed red, green, and blue lights. The objects to the north appeared to be an elliptical through 8 to 12 power lens. They then turned to full circles. The objects to the north remained in the sky for an hour or more. The object to the south was visible for 2 or 3 hours and beamed down a stream of light from time to time. Numerous individuals, including the undersigned witnesses and activities and paragraphs. So this is – then he signs it, and then a whole bunch of other people that saw it also signed this letter confirming.
Yeah, so it's not like a – like it's a very clinical, I think, description of what happened. One of the downsides, I believe he misdates the – memo. I think he gives the dates that it was the 28th, night of the 28th and morning of the 29th.
Yeah.
And it was actually the 27th and 28th, which causes all future investigations of this incident, like security tapes and whatever else, to be incorrect because they're looking at the wrong night, which is possibly one of the biggest bungles in UFO investigation history.
And I feel like with that, it's almost excusable because they happen so late, in the, you know, like at 3 in the morning or like overnight.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like, okay, I see where you screwed up kind of thing. Like, yeah, I don't look too much into that.
No, I don't think it was an intentional thing. I just think he made a boo-boo And
yeah, absolutely.
And it really bungled future investigations because then there was no reason to like save any of the records from the night of the actual occurrence. And so it all got deleted. Or did he actually put the correct night and then somebody did a little whiteout, little change the date and got all the records deleted that way? Huh?
It's very weird. There's a lot of
government conspiracy. You still there?
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I got distracted. I got into a Wikipedia. I was looking at the skeptical analysis of it, and I was.
when Holt and his boys roll back to the base, they pass John Burroughs and Adrian Bastenza on the way. Even though they're not on duty, they were just kind of curious what was going on. Mm-hmm. And they asked for permission to go check it out. He says, yeah, sure, whatever. It's mostly over. And so they go to the field where Holt and them had just seen all this stuff. And they see a light in the field. And as they approach it, it takes off. And Bastenza says that he tells Burroughs, hey, man, when that light shined on us for a second, you disappeared for a minute before you came, and then you came back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which is a weird detail. And that's all the UFO sightings.
Wasn't there one thing? I feel like we might have covered it the last time about someone who was questionable if they were there or not.
Yeah. So after all this goes down, 2 weeks after the initial interview with Sergeant Peniston, everybody gets called back in for further debriefing by the OSI, which is the Office of Special Investigation, which is probably where the men in black are, if they're
right. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I've never heard of the Office of Special Investigation outside of this.
That sounds evil.
Yeah. So he makes another statement, but he's afraid that they're going to end his career because, as we established, Peniston is very serious, mm-hmm. so serious. And so he kind of cleans up his story to sound a little less fantastic. He does sketches for them. And then he says that the rest of the interview is a blur. He believes now that he was given sodium pentothal. Oh. And that he also probably consented to being given sodium pentothal to try and, like, oh, I'm a good sport. I'll take sodium pentothal, whatever. I'll take your
Never
2-0.
Take sodium pentothal. Oh, wait, did you see, was it in Deadpool 2?
Oh,
where
yeah.
They had the true serum. It was true not serum. True serum. Oh, it's the true serum. That was fun.
Ant-Man. I think it was Ant-Man.
Ant-Man, you're right. You're right. It was Ant-Man. Yes, yes. That was a good, I really liked that one.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Sergeant Adrian Bastenza is also questioned. He says he was taken to a room beneath the base for questioning, which is creepy, and he refuses to speak publicly about it now. Although, according to some sources, he told them that the OSI tried to convince him that it was the lighthouse, and he said, yes. No, it did some weird stuff. It wasn't the lighthouse. And then they said, bullets are cheap. And he was like, oh, it's probably a lighthouse. and then Airman Kabansag said he was forced to sign paperwork saying that nothing out of the ordinary happened. So there's that.
Yeah, there was... and some of the... I don't know, the skeptics... But I think we need to take a look at those just to say how, you know...
Yeah, it's... I think Larry Warren is what you're talking about.
So, oh, yeah, yes.
Yeah, he's after... well, nothing else really happens with this for, like, 3 years. Burroughs is on guard duty again, and he says that he sees weird covert activity in the woods, and Holt also says that he thinks that took place.
Mm.
But... then he sends the memo to the Ministry of Defense and the RAF, and nothing happens.
Yeah.
Until October 2nd, 1983, when a British Sunday tabloid news... British Sunday tabloid News of the World breaks the story with the actual memo that Holt sent. which was leaked to the public by former Bentwaters Air Force security policeman Larry Warren, who is the most, by far the most controversial figure in this story. So Larry Warren, according to Larry Warren, after midnight on December 29th, 1980, which would be the night after Halt's expedition.
Yeah.
He was stationed at Bentwaters. He was removed from his post and ordered to go into the woods to help with Halt's investigation. So he's alleging that it actually was on the 29th, the 28th, 29th, instead of the 27th, 28th.
Yeah, so he's going off the written statement of it as opposed to what all the witnesses are saying.
Yes. He says that they, that's the first kind of inconsistency. The next inconsistency is that he says they came to a clearing, and instead of just seeing marks on the ground like Halt did, he says they see a group of military personnel around a glowing object. And when they get within a few feet, they realize that it's a bunch of officers and airmen facing the object with three small glowing humanoid entities standing in front of it. So the officers seem to be engaging in some kind of protocol, talking with the entities, and then Warren...
I just picture that picture from Men in Black where Tommy Lee Jones is like giving the bouquet of flowers to like the white, the giant gray.
The Warren is then pulled from the clearing without explanation. He's brought into a room for debriefing with the other witnesses. He says, they have a projector and three men in suits, hence the, Men in Black. And then they show them films of UFO activity involved with the military going back to what looked like the 40s to him. And then after that, he also says his memories became more and more distorted, but he believes that he was taken against his will by men in dark suits under the base, that he was strapped to a table, that he remembers being in a mess hall alone at a table, and he wasn't sure if these memories were real or planted.
Yeah, his story, I think it kind of almost, it contradicts with what, was it Burroughs, who did the, who was debriefed and they told him bullets are cheap?
Yeah. Oh, that was Kabansag, I think.
Kabansag. You know, so if those guys saw something and the more likely real OSI are just like, hey, we're just going to kill you if you don't shut up about it. They're going to take some other guy, tell him everything that happened in UFO lore, like show him all these UFO videos, and then brainwash him to do some shit. I don't know.
Yeah.
These are two crazy, very different methods.
It's really bizarre, and Warren's story really conflicts with the other guy's stories in several different ways. And pretty much all the other witnesses are really upset with Warren because they're like, this guy wasn't actually there. None of them remember him. None of them remember ever seeing him or meeting him or knowing that he existed. And they think he's just there to discredit them or just to like hang on to their coattails or whatever. But he's the only one out of all of the witnesses who said anything about aliens, like seeing actual aliens. And he really brings like a, like it's one thing to believe that a bunch of military guys saw lights in the woods and that were weird, but Warren's story, it's got aliens, it's got government cover up, it's got like weird Men in Black brainwashing.
Yeah.
So
it's an even more fun version of an already really fun UFO story. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, someone made a movie of like the real one, which is fun, you know, and I think there's part of, you know, as fans of conspiracies and cryptids and aliens, I think there is a bit of us that, you know, there's some people that we know they're just full of shit,
Yeah.
But it's kind of part of the thing. Like, it's still just a fun story. It's a tall tale.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tall tale. And even if it's, like, blatantly made up, it's entertaining. Whatever. If they're trying to sell some books, okay. Absolutely. But then you have people like – I'm just going to put the names out there, like Joshua P. Warren or someone out there who, like, sells wishing machines. You know what I mean? Where you're taking advantage of people and telling them, we're going to make your life better if you give me $500 to make a wishing machine. Like,
exactly.
That's a lot of difference. And I don't know. That's just something that's bothered me. And, like, you don't really see that in this story too much besides the guy, like, hawking his video, which I think the guy's full of crap.
Yeah.
But he's still, you know, it's fun. But he is screwing up the real story.
Usually it's victimless when somebody has a crazy story like this. You know, it's just somebody making a weird claim, whether you believe them or not, it doesn't really matter. And you can just, like, appreciate it for what it is and go on. But this guy is a little different because there's other people who had a weird experience that affected them. And like Jim Peniston, in one of the documentaries I saw, they, like, returned to Rendlesham Forest, and he, like, had to stop and cry for a minute before he, like, walked into the woods. Like, he got real emotional about it. And this guy is like, delegitimizing with his story. I mean, assuming it's not true, which is, I mean, maybe it is real, but, I mean, it doesn't make sense with anybody else's story. Oh, hello, Cthulhu. Hello. He could be a disinformation agent. I think that's kind of what Peniston and a lot of the other guys think, is that it is a conspiracy and he's been sent by the military or whoever to discredit them.
Like the are you familiar with the Paul Benovitz case with Richard Doty?
No.
Okay, so there's a really good documentary I encourage everyone to go watch. It's on Netflix and Hulu and the like, called Mirage Men. And it's all about this. And so this is 100% true. There was a man who was a good guy. He was a rancher. He had retired from an aerospace company he had made. So he's a rich guy, you know, done really well for himself. And I think he was in the Air Force in, like, Korea or something. So he was like a, you know, that age in, like, the 90s, let's just say this was the 90s, I think. And he lived right by a base, by an Air Force base. And so at this Air Force base, they were testing top secret stuff. You know, let's just, you know, drones or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so he saw these things, and he didn't know what they were. And so he had a good relationship with some guys in the military right there, because he had worked in the aerospace industry.
Yeah.
And he told him, like, hey, there's some weird stuff going over at your base. You know, I'm seeing stuff over there every night flying over, and it's not planes. You know, I know what planes look like. This guy was a pilot on top of all this. And so now the Air Force is like, oh, crap. This guy knows something's going on, you know?
Yeah.
And he might tell someone, trying to do the right thing, you know, trying to help out. And so what they did, they got someone, this man named Richard Doty, who was a intelligence officer in the Air Force, I believe. And they fed him these stories up until the point of broadcasting fake radio signals into his house to convince him that these were UFOs.
Whoa.
And aliens. And they would even do all this stuff and mess with him. So he would think he was going crazy and that these are UFOs. So he wouldn't tell people, hey, there's, like, a top secret thing going on over here. They would even give him, like, fake photos and just total disinformation on this. And it's crazy. I can't do it justice. But go watch Mirage Men.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix. It's really good. You don't even have to be a UFO, really into UFOs, to appreciate it. It's just – and it's not one of those shows that's going to prove aliens are real or – you know, it's not. It's just showing, like, this is how they covered it up. This is how disinformation worked. With, you know, evidence and everything, and this, they ruined this guy's life.
Dang.
Trying to stop him from doing this. I think the guy even had a mental breakdown, had to go to a mental institution, and because he was trying to be, like, you know, a good patriotic American and let them know about these UFOs and stuff, and they just played him. So that definitely is something that happens in the UFO community, especially. You know, we saw that with the names are escaping me right now, but there's two people that were really involved in the UFO community, like, in, I wanted to say was with MUFON, but they came out at that convention. You can go find the video of this where he says, "Oh, by the way, I admit to being a government agent." I can't remember the guy's name, but it's from like the 80s or 90s. And this guy's, God, hold on, let me find this guy's name real fast, because it's a name you'll probably recognize.
Because I can't think of what the story is, but it sounds fascinating.
As to being covered. This is covered in the documentary as well. Golly, which one was it? I can't. It's not important for right now, but it's in the documentary, and it's the government has been working with these guys who were faces of the UFO community and researchers with stuff like, hey, kind of like what we're seeing with Tom DeLonge right now, in my opinion, where, hey, we're going to give you a little bit of information.
That's
you know?
Absolutely.
And,
you know,
and they think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. I have, like, if you've ever heard Tom DeLonge talk about, like, on Coast to Coast or Joe Rogan.
A bunch, yeah.
Like, he sounds insane, but I don't think he's lying. I think he actually met with some person in the Pentagon or whatever. And they were like, this dude wants it so bad, let's give it to him. We'll put out the craziest disinfo, and then, like, we can make him say whatever, basically. Because,
that's kind of what I think about. I don't think he's pranking us or anything. I think more than like more than likely there's some at least some level of different information government interference going on in that, as well intentioned as it is.
Absolutely.
But in this case, you know, you saw these guys, the government infiltrate these groups, and it's still going on today, I'm sure, in a variety of things, whether it be political or UFOs. So, it could very well happen. But I thought one of the other interesting skeptic ideas about this, most of them revolve around just the lights themselves saying, oh, it was a lighthouse, right?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it was a fireball, it was a meteor. Okay, that doesn't explain the stuff flying around maneuvering through the woods like an Evil Dead camera angle. You know, it doesn't make sense.
We had exactly the same problem on the Flatwoods episode last night. There was something very similar that happened in that. But so there was a guy named, he was a retired U.S. Air Force major named James McGeehy, who also was an astronomer. I guess that's what he did in the Air Force, maybe. And I guess he took it upon himself to, like, debunk this story because he was stationed at the base in 1983, and he was like, oh, 5 miles away, there's this lighthouse. You can totally see it. And he says all of these lights were just the lighthouse. The movement is an illusion because as the lighthouse rotates, it reflects off of trees. And it's like, that's it. It was that. Also, on December 25th, at 9:30, he says a Cosmos satellite re-entered the atmosphere. And he's like, between those two things, that's all there was.
Ugh,
but John Burroughs in his report says, we saw the lighthouse and we thought it was a second UFO for a second. And then we realized, no, this one's just the lighthouse.
Yeah.
So, like, built into the story is the
debunking of that idea. to harp back on an earlier point, these guys are professional airmen, you know, these guys literally live on an Air Force base. Their job is to see planes every single day, work on planes every single day, make sure the commies aren't bombing you. They know what their planes look like. You know what I mean? Like, it's,
well, and I
almost
said
insulting.
That Burroughs had been stationed at this base for a year and a half before this incident. So presumably he would have seen the lighthouse at some point before, because the lighthouse didn't move. So surely he would have at some point in that year and a half seen these lights before, or anybody else would have seen them. You know, it's just,
where were we?
The
debunks.
Yeah, we just talked about Major James McGeehee talking about Orford Ness Lighthouse.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the RAF formally investigated this whole thing in 1981. I guess that January, probably, after Holt sent this memo and stuff. But apparently some of the radar facilities were faulty and some of the camera rolls went missing. So that, combined with the mistake Holt made in the date, caused the investigation to basically go nowhere, and the USAF concluded that there was no threat to national security, which I think is fascinating because, I mean, sounds like a lot of stuff was going wrong
at
this nuclear weapon storage facility. And, I mean, regardless of whether or not you found anything on radar or on camera, you have the testimony of like 10 people who say they saw weird lights in the forest. So
moving around.
Yeah, either there actually are lights in the forest, or you have 10 guys, including the number two in command, who are seeing stuff or misinterpreting mundane lights.
Yeah. Either it happened or every single person working at this base should be fired.
Yeah. Either way, it's a security issue.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think another thing that supports this actually happening is that there are civilian witnesses who saw weird stuff that night. On in the early morning hours of December 27th, 1980, Roy and Marina Webb and their little daughter were driving home from a family gathering, and the daughter saw a shooting star and started talking nonstop about it. But it started like flying parallel to them. So they pulled over and the light also stopped. And then it appeared to like sit and watch them for a minute before shooting off down the road really fast.
Yeah. And I think there were, I haven't written my notes, that there were, including the military, like about 80 witnesses over these couple days.
I believe it. 'Cause in my like cursory search for other witnesses, I found there's those three, and then there's a guy who lives in Woodbridge named Jerry Harris, who walked across his yard and saw lights over the trees dipping and rising very quickly. And then I think there were a couple other people in that documentary, but like, it's not just limited to the military base. There were other people who saw it, so.
Yeah, I think it just lends more credibility to it.
Yeah.
Now, you said when we were getting started that you had first heard about this through a cryptid case.
Yeah, I don't remember some of the details, but it was definitely, actually, maybe it was like a listener write-in or something on another podcast, but somebody said that they were stationed near or at maybe Bentwaters, and we're driving down one of those roads that circles the base late at night, and they saw basically a Bigfoot, like an 8-foot tall ape-like entity that like walked across the road. They had to slam on the brakes. It kind of looked at them and like did like that classic New Yorker, like, "Hey, I'm walking here.
Forget about it."
Forget about it. He like looked at him angry, like, "Oh, I can't believe you just almost hit me," and then just like stomped off. And they were like, "Whoa, what just happened?"
It was weird.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot, you know, with these, you know, UFOs and Bigfoot kind of showing up in similar places like that, kind of like we talked about at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, it is weird how things mingle together. Like, have you listened to Last Podcast on the Left's series on the Men in Black?
Yes. Oh, that's a great, it just ended fairly recently. And, I just re-listened to the Mothman one a couple nights ago, actually.
There,
the part three, I think.
Yeah,
so talk about Mothman.
Both of those cases are so bizarre. And like whenever there's like I also recently explained to my wife what a UFO flap was, that usually it's not, you see one UFO and then it's done. It's you see a UFO and then the next night you see another one, and then three nights later, six other people see one, you know, it's like a yeah. series of UFO sightings in the same area.
And like then, Gulf Breeze or something.
Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes a chupacabra will show up
yeah.
or like there'll be a haunted mansion that starts up nearby or something. Like it just get weird stuff happens. Like Indrid Cold. Like what is going on with that guy? Like that's when the Mothman really gets crazy.
Yeah. And I just got that book actually.
I need to get it. I'm so excited. I've never actually read it. And
Me either.
I had not realized the depths of the weirdness.
Yeah, that's what I'd been listening to that the last podcast episode. I'm like, I just got to read this. You know, it's a conspiracy classic. It's
yeah. Or,
one of the – I borrow something from George Knapp is High Strangeness.
Yeah.
Like this is – I mean, it's just – Bigfoots, there's government cover-ups, you know, when he kind of uses that term to encapsulate all this crazy stuff going on. And I think, and this is very strange.
Yeah, it is really weird, but if you actually read anything about it, Mothman is probably the least strange part.
Oh yeah.
Of that whole story. And I think that actually is the case with a lot of these UFO sightings and cryptid sightings. It's just, maybe we don't hear as much about it.
Yeah.
So,
I think that kind of, does that wrap it up?
Yeah. I don't think I have anything else.
No, I don't think I do.
I think this is 100% real. Well, I guess maybe 90% real. Cause I think Larry Warren is not real.
Yeah. We don't have to count that.
But other than that, 100% real.
I believe it. I'm not saying it's extraterrestrials because I think that's a leap. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be them. It could be interdimensional things. It could just be, a test thing. I don't know. But these dudes, I believe them that they believe they saw something. There's no reason really to doubt that many people when there's physical evidence, like the grass marks, and there's very credible witnesses who would see planes every single day. I think this case and the Phoenix Lights case for me when I was younger, like cemented it for me, you know, like, oh, this is definitely a thing, that, you know, UFOs and extraterrestrials and the cover up. I really love the Rendlesham case. It has a special place in my heart just because it's so wild, you know, and it's just, yeah. Especially with the downloads and, you know, the Cold War, it's just a really good one.
The binary, the weird tie-ins, yes, to the pyramids,
it's a fun one too. You know, it's not, it's good, and it's not all like secondhand, like, you know, channeled knowledge, psychically channeled knowledge, like you get a lot with UFO crap. But it's like,
with the exception of Larry Warren, there's literally no like iffy part of this story. Everything is like very reliable and easy to believe until he comes along, and that's it. And it's easy to believe that he's lying. So,
yeah, I think he's full of it. But
yeah, for sure.
Everything else.
Well, cool, man. Well, this has been great.
Yeah, this is fun. The second time, I think we did better this time than the first time.
Absolutely. Maybe we should do this on all our podcasts.
Yes, I like it.
Well, if you guys want to listen to my show, you can find me. We're the Slothman Prophecies podcast, or you can tweet us, follow us on Twitter at Slothpod, or send us a Gmail at slothpod@gmail.com. And you can follow the Michaels on TX Files. I still think you guys should do Tex Files. It's so
yeah, I feel like everyone pronounces it Text Files.
Yeah.
Every time I hear someone say it, like, oh yeah, Text Files, I'm like, well, yeah, why not, sure, whatever.
And you guys are at TX Files on Twitter too, right?
TX_files. For Patreon and Instagram, just / the TX Files.
Oh nice, you guys got that Patreon. I need to get on that.
And I suggest everyone, podcast-wise, should get one. I mean, you know, people like the shows. It's, don't feel like you're begging for money. You know, I feel like it's kind of an autonomous thing. It's all voluntary. And it really helps the shows when you give like even a dollar, like, you know, and everyone's very appreciative of it. Trust me. Like if you gave a nickel, a podcaster would probably like show you their butthole. They'd love you so much.
So, I know I would.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's awesome, but don't feel obligated to do anything like that, especially, you know, if you can't, if for whatever reasons. But one thing that would definitely help both of our shows is to go on iTunes and leave us both 5-star reviews, please.
Yes.
It really helps the shows, you know, get more attention and kind of go up get some more eyes on them and ears on them. So we really would appreciate it if you did that.
Yeah, please. Those 5-star reviews. I've been stuck at 14 for months now.
So. Yeah, one of the best ones we got recently, we were just called like two ignorant bigots who nice. Would Idiocracy if Idiocracy had a podcast or something. It's like, I don't know. I think I said something bad about like Trump people or something, but
I have yet to receive any negative reviews, and I'm actually glad that we're almost to 30. I think we're coming out with our 25th episode soon.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe by 30 I'll be able to handle it if somebody says I'm a tinfoil hat moron.
Right. Yeah, we had one, like, really early on, one star that was – we had made a joke about with another podcast, the Slaughter Podcast, which is a good show, about how they didn't want to eat biscuits and gravy. We were kind of having, like, a little show joke, you know.
Yeah.
Biscuits and gravy between our two shows. And Michael was like, if they don't like biscuits and gravy, I'm going to punch them in the face. Or something like innocuous.
That sounds like what he would say. Yeah.
A joke. And then someone wrote like a 2-paragraph thing about how it's not okay to joke about, you know, violence to women or something. I was like, yeah, obviously. But yeah, I don't know. Just we appreciate the good reviews.
Yeah. And the sad ones crush us more than you'll ever know. And I guess on that note, we can get out of here because it's getting pretty hot and my cat is just thinking so hard about jumping on top of this blanket fort.
Oh, my cat is right next to me asleep.
Oh, jealous.
In his little bed. All right, man, this was fun.
Yeah,
thank you all for listening, and we'll be back hopefully with another crossover sometime.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Later. You.